Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dog-Eared Corner. We may not have baseball news to talk about, but we do have a great baseball book to talk about, and that is The Science of Baseball by Will Carroll. And I'm joined by the author today. Thanks for joining me, Will.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity. It was such an honor for anybody to read this, so it's great to be able to talk about it right here, just ahead of the release. I'm excited.
Yeah, and you know, I found it really enjoyable. I was kind of expecting the injury expert to lead with more injuries, but you held off until chapter 14 or so. I know that you've got other books out there specifically about pitcher injuries, and was it hard for you not to delve right into the physiological aspects of the game?
Yeah, no. When I was approached to the book, my first reaction was no. Because I didn't think I was the right person for it. But the more I thought about it, it's just like the other books. There wasn't a book out there like that that I could just go pick up and read. So I had to write it, which I think are the best books. My goal for the book was twofold. First, I wanted to write a book that, you know, it's so tough for me to articulate this one. There was a teenage me. Who picked up a book, and I don't remember what it was, had to do a book report, and it helped me fall in love with baseball a different way. I wasn't great, you know, I played up to the level I could, but, you know, reading about it, learning about it, you know, studying it, the history of it, and to some extent the science of it, really helped me fall in love with it and learn that there are other ways to be around baseball. So this book is hopefully paying that forward. I hope that this book will be in a library and some kid somewhere will say, ah, crap, I got to do a book report. Or, you know, mom's making me read a book for the summer program and they pick one up and it shows them a little something. So there's that element up. The other was that I really wanted to get to the basics of baseball. I know for a book called Science, that's probably not the easiest one. But, you know, really for me, I wanted to start with the most basic level and really understand it. And as I thought it through, I said, yeah, that's the baseball. That's the baseball bat. I have to lead with that. And those are the first two chapters. And I think for a lot of people, they're the most shocking ones, that there's more to it than just here's a ball, here's a bat.
Absolutely. And looking at the subtitle of your book, The Math, Technology, and Data Behind the Great American Pastime, I came into it maybe predisposed to think, oh, we're going to talk Magnus force. We're going to talk drag coefficients. The things that I've seen in Meredith Wills, who you talk about right there in the first chapter. But you're bringing it to a level that's much more approachable. And I found that really helped enhance my understanding and enjoyment of the book. Was that, you know, you mentioned trying to get it to where you can have kids pick this up and they're getting a deeper understanding and appreciation of the game. So that was really important for you all along?
Yeah. I didn't want people to be just blown away by the science. You know, if you pick up a book called The Science of Baseball rather than The Physics of Baseball, you know, Robert Adair's classic. I was so scared of being next to a shelf, you know, if they shelved by, you know, subject rather than alphabetically by author or something. That scares me because mm-hmm. That's an absolute classic. Or The Science of Hitting by Ted Williams, another book that it's going to get compared to and poorly. I wanted it to be accessible and yet kind of be that half step. Be like, okay, I get this. I want to know more about this particular thing. And I think, hopefully, what the book does is give somebody enough of an understanding that they can get a better appreciation for it and also kind of be a signpost. You know, if you really want to dig into the science, the physics behind what Dr. Wills has done with the two baseball problem, or if you really want to understand what Keenan Long has done to figure out that bats are so different, it's just an amazing story that, you know, until just a couple of years ago, nobody had thought of. Yeah, this gives you kind of a signpost to, do you want to really get into the physics, or do you want to just have a little bit more understanding of how things work in baseball and why the game is progressing the way it is?
Yeah. So those first couple chapters, obviously, really, really hooked me, talking about the ball and some of the things that it's out there. The info is out there, but you brought it all together into one place and you really distilled it. That was really nice. But then the bat was even more. That's something that I haven't seen. Dr. Wills has been in Sports Illustrated and The Athletic, but what was the most interesting part of your research into technological advances in bats?
Yeah, just talking to Keenan. And I got to meet him in person. Writing a book during a pandemic is an interesting experience because, it's usually a fairly solo thing, but this book was kind of taking in a bunch of really smart people and figuring out how to get them to tell you things. What Keenan does is exceptionally secret. There's only a few people in the world that know how he does what he does. It's kind of like the Coca-Cola formula. What Keenan does, his company is called Long Ball Labs. They will take a box of bats, usually comes in a dozen. They do some magic test, and he can tell you which bat is better than another bat. And there can be a huge difference, the equivalent of 20 feet of distance between one bat and another bat. And I know some of it, and he hints at it in the book, that some of it is the wood makeup and some of it is how the bat is ground down and turned on the lathe, things like that. But there's more to it. Just the things he was able to tell me and that I hopefully was able to convey are just stunning. Things that we've been doing for literally, almost 200 years. People may not have been playing baseball 200 years ago, but they were turning axe handles and other things, which would have had much the same effect. So it's pretty astounding that here we are in 2022, not just finding new technologies, but finding new technologies for wood.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And just a note, this is a Cleveland baseball blog. Debunking the myth of corking a bat kind of seemed like justice for Albert Bell, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. That was one of the things that was really interesting to me. I went to a school with a lot of engineers, and so they were always trying to figure things out, and we cryo-dipped bats, and we heard about boning bats, which actually turns out it works a little bit. There are so many myths around it that it's really intriguing to be able to do that deep dive into the science of it. Why does this work? What does this work? And to have someone like Keenan and the others that talked to me through the book was just absolutely amazing.
Another thing that, moving on in the book that I found really fascinating was I've heard a lot about the pitching technology, the Rapsodos and on and on. You got into how technology is starting to help hitters. And I really found that to be interesting. It was kind of like the counterpoint to the MVP machine that Ben Lindbergh and Travis Sochik wrote a few years ago, that section, because this was news to me. I didn't know about hit tracks and so on and how you could, you could get app data to help understand the biomechanics and all that. Do you see those leaps being made to kind of level the playing field between hitters and pitchers?
Yes. Yeah. HitTrax is really amazing. What HitTrax is, it's a camera and radar system. The machine itself looks like one of those old USA Today machines. I'm really dating myself by saying, oh, it's a newspaper dispenser, old chap, but it's about that size, and it's got cameras and radar, and what it can do is basically tracks the ball in, tracks the swing, and then essentially figures out through exit velocity, launch angle, all those kind of things, where the ball would go. The genius of it is that Mike D and the guys over there, Mike D Francesco, who's the CEO, what they've done is basically overlaid it onto a video game. So you can be here in Indianapolis, over at the University of Indianapolis's training facility indoors, and you can be hitting in Progressive Field. You could be hitting at San Diego. All the kids love San Diego. I'm trying to figure out why that park more than others in most. But they'll get in there, and the University of Indianapolis baseball team, which I worked with a couple of years ago, there was one particular kid, Caleb Vaughn, who's now their leadoff hitter, plays center field, had a walk-off home run in the conference tournament last year. This kid will go in there, and without really thinking about it, is basically playing a video game and making himself a better hitter. The pitching machine is firing things in, and man, he is firing some things out. He had thousands of pitches a month. And you think about the, you know, it's not a terribly inexpensive machine. It's very expensive. But the idea that this kind of technology exists at all, and then hopefully it'll become more and more accessible. If we can make practice fun and make it completely irreliant on the conditions, that's something that we can do. And then, you know, there's even more advanced technologies that we're seeing moving in beyond that.
Yeah, that it's really interesting. And just how that is going to change the game for the better. And also kind of democratizing it when the apps are rolling out on smartphones, like the biomechanical feedback app that you mentioned in the book.
ProPlay?
Yeah.
Yeah. Full disclosure, I worked for ProPlay and still do a lot of stuff with them, but it is an absolutely amazing thing. You know, it used to be for biomechanics, you would have to go to a lab, you would have to strip down, get in spandex and put on markers. I can remember when Rick Peterson, who a lot of people probably remember as the pitching coach in Moneyball, when he was with the Mets, he took a group of pitchers down there. And one of them was Scott Kazmir, who was later traded to the Rays. He was not comfortable at all. They went to Birmingham to the American Society or American Sports Medicine Institute. You know, it was like going to one of those sleep labs, if you've ever done that, where they put a whole bunch of wires on you, tell you they're going to have a camera on you, and then, oh, sleep normally. It's really tough. It's the same thing. If you're basically in your underwear with a bunch of little reflective balls and markers taped to you, and then they say pitch normally, it doesn't happen very often. I can remember a company I worked with did that kind of biomechanical testing. And one of the first guys I looked for was a kid named Michael Kopech, who's now with the White Sox. And Michael is very famous for throwing the ball really, really hard. He's been as high as 105. So I was like, I want to see this kid's mechanics. I know they did him the year before. And I looked, and he throwed 80 miles an hour. And I'm like, well, that was a warm-up pitch. It wasn't exactly competitive. What ProPlay does is instead of having to have all those cameras, all those markers, basically you just do it on your phone. You can take an iPhone, an Android, and do it in slow-mo just like you would take a normal video, send it to the cloud, and in a couple minutes, it tells you what your biomechanics are. And it's lab accurate. Is it perfect? No, but it's lab accurate. And the thing I love about the system is when it gets a bad result, man, it is a bad result. You know it's a bad result, and you're just like, okay, I'll take that one again. It's not like you're guessing. And it's almost always user error. So you're able to go through that and say, hey, here it is. I've taken video from the stands and Progressive. I remember having one of Garrett Crochet was one of the first ones I did, and his mechanics are surprisingly smooth. You can do it, at the field, you can do it in the bullpen, you can do it in game, you can do it in a garage. And there are a couple of programs out there like that. Tom House has his Mustard coaching program that uses similar technology, and it works a little bit differently. But the idea that this technology is out there and hopefully getting to more and more kids, I think is just going to make baseball a better game.
Yeah, absolutely. And is this going to help maybe this isn't exactly correlated, but you mentioned how high school, travel ball, colleges, they're arm shredders, to use your term. Is having this kind of feedback available and hopefully, you know, at lower cost than Rapsodo machines and all that, is that going to help keep kids' arms safer, more protected from heavy workloads as at a young age? Do you see any advantage there?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, the problem is that, you know, all we have at most levels is pitch counts, and in travel organizations, there tend not to be regulations. I mean, one of the biggest step forwards was when MLB's Pitch Smart went to Little League and gave them those pitch count regulations. The problem was, and I can remember telling Glenn Fleissig this, who was the head of it and the head of the ASMI, there was going to be unintended consequences. There's going to be parents that take their kids somewhere else that walk away from these regulations. That's what we've seen. And so we've also seen the increases in arm injuries and arm surgeries. There's a huge growth in Tommy John surgery at the 14-15 level. We've seen Tommy John on kids as low as 11 years old. There's a story I tell that's from about 7 years ago now, but a kid's parent called and said, "Hey, is there a doctor you'd recommend? I need to get my kid's elbow looked at." It turns out the kid was playing for three different travel teams. And so he was starting as many as three games a week and often throwing seven inning complete games. So, you know, it was 200 to 220 pitches in a week with very little rest. He was good, but you know what? He had Tommy John surgery. And the surprising thing was he was pretty good, went to college, got drafted in a really low round, and I don't remember what happened to him. But it's just the idea that a parent would do that, that a coach would – the coaches didn't know. So this one was on the parent. But if we have more data out there, if one of these technologies allows us to say, you know, here's all the pitches this kid is throwing, hopefully that common sense will be allowed to kick in, because you tell that story and everybody's like, oh my God, this parent, somebody needs to stab him in the eye. And that's, you know, maybe a little extreme, but close. It is that we need to be taking care of these kids rather than, you know, living vicariously through them and putting them in situations that aren't healthy. You know, some of these showcase events where, you know, kids are given one inning to show off for a scholarship. You know, did they do a good warm up? Were they in shape for this, you know, January or August event? Are they built up, or are they gassed at the end of their season? You see too many injuries in those situations. You know, they're with the college baseball season barely underway, there have already been two guys, you know, one was this weekend, I haven't seen a report on it, walked off the mound, looked like something happened to his arm, waiting to see whether a guy who's, you know, potentially a first two round pitcher blew out his arm. We had that, you know, three first round picks last year. Luckily, Tommy John has gotten so good that, you know, teams kind of shrug their shoulders at it. And say, okay, so they drop 8 or 10 places. So that's only $1 million or $1.5 million. So they still get to play, but you know, it remains costly in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and in addition, one thing you do a great job laying out in the book is the progressive development of pitchers in particular, and you compare it to weightlifting and how no one steps up and does 300 pounds on their first deadlift or whatever. How do you get that message to resonate beyond your book to get to the levels that it needs to, like you said, where it's common sense and coaches and parents are using that to benefit the athletes?
Yeah, I wish I had a great answer to this, but here's the hard truth to that section of the book. I actually wrote the bulk of that in 2006. It was a piece that I wrote at Baseball Prospectus. And, you know, I published it then. I published an update to it a couple of years ago on my own blog. And then it still holds true. This is a system that is, you know, not difficult. You know, like you said, it's basically the same thing we do if we wanted to, you know, increase a bench press or run a marathon. You don't just go out and say, you know what, I think I'll run a marathon today. You build up to it. You build mileage. You have one of these crazy training programs. There's apps for that. And it should be the same for pitching, and yet it's not. The interesting thing to me is that a progressive system would actually tell us who the outliers are. Everybody goes, why don't guys be like Nolan Ryan and throw 200 pitches? There are probably guys out there that could. We just don't have a way of identifying them. So instead, we have people that pull guys at 100 pitches, got to go out 100 pitches. Why? Why? Because most don't know the actual answer. Well, it's in the book. So I won't tease you like that. It's Paul Richard, who was one of the great minds of the 1950s and 60s. Pretty much if anybody ever tells you there was a baseball advance and you don't know who it was either Branch Rickey or Paul Richard. So he actually did it because it was a round number. He had actually done a study and come up with, I want to say it was 97 was the real number where guys started to get fatigued, but rounded it to 100 for his scouts. And there's really no more research to it than that. So it's one of those things where, again, something from 15, 16 years ago that I wrote still holds true today. And there's very few of those.
Yeah. Moving on to a little bit later in the book here, maybe my favorite section was the cheats. And with spider tack and trash can lids and all that in the news so much with baseball, I found it really fascinating that you went back. You first of all laid out how spitballs worked, which I don't think I've ever actually read anywhere. So that was really fascinating. But you also laid out other things that the players are still doing to gain an advantage, such as like basting spray to get a better grip on the ball, which I hadn't seen anywhere else. What was the most fascinating area of cheating that you found?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, there are so many of them. Spider tack and all the sticky substances were so interesting. I think for me, it was talking to people around the game that steal signs. And I don't mean in the way that that people think the Astros did it. Banging on the trash can lid is the crudest method you've ever seen. There was, the famous white shirt guy in Toronto. There are college teams. There is a college team I know that it's not the most high tech system, but it's probably the most audacious. They actually took a kid. It was students that ran the system, so good teaching on them. They had one of the students with kind of a long lens camera take pictures of the cards that coaches would use, to call plays. You would call out like 5, 6, 7, and you see people wearing these on wristbands, kind of like a quarterback. And it's a certain pitch or it's a certain play, a certain defensive setup. But for pitch calling, they basically had it. And I watched the kid do it. I was like, this can't be what I think it is. And then watching the rest of the game, there were two small cards, it looked like a white, note card, like a 3x5. And think about how small that is. But there was a student on one side who would put it over the foul pole. So all the kid had to do, a right-handed batter would look down to right field, left-handed batter would look down to left field. And if it was going to be a breaking ball, there would be a card. If it was a fastball or a changeup, it wasn't. So they pretty much knew what pitch was coming on every pitch. And these kids didn't miss. Absolutely pounded the ball. Good hitters, but like the Astros, if good hitters know what's coming, they can do a lot of damage. So you see things like this. But at the major league level, it's supercomputers and machine learning and computer vision and learning machines. One team that was using AWS, which is the Amazon Web Services, in the cloud, it was moving so fast that it could tell you not only what pitch patterns it thought was coming, it would tell you what pitch it thought was coming, and it got more and more accurate because it was reading the pitcher, it was reading the signs, it was reading the dugout. There's one that told me they were trying to listen to the sounds, but they hadn't gotten terribly accurate with that. But sign stealing is not just you know figuring it out. Even just a camera, which is an easy way to do, or a note card in the outfield banging on a trash can. That's the most primitive level of it. The things some teams are doing are so far beyond the pale that it's not just cheating. It's super cheating.
Yeah. Well, I think that leads me nicely into my last question. I've kept you here long enough, I think. You end the book with some predictions, and we don't have to go through them all. I encourage everyone to read it. What do you think, and maybe it's related to technological advances and cheating, what do you think is the most likely of your predictions in the short term, the near term here?
Yeah, that's writing a book is kind of hubris to begin with, because you're saying, here, I'm putting a flag down. And you know, I wrote a book called Saving the Pitcher back in 2004, which was about pitching injuries. And the things we knew in 2004 and the things we know now are so entirely different. To this day, I'll have parents pick up the book and say, "Oh, I got your book." And I'm like, "No, put it back. there's better books." It was great at the time. It's nice as a moment in time, but don't treat your kids by it. I think, putting those kind of, markers in the sand, planting your flag in a period of time, you have to do for a book, because nobody's come up with those Harry Potter books that change and have video and everything else. So it's difficult to say. I do have to say, being in Cleveland podcast, I'm completely stealing the format for that last chapter from Keith Woolner, who's the head of data. I forget his actual title now, over at the Cleveland Guardians. And he did a whole series back in 1999 where he took a mathematical kind of legendary format called the Hebert questions and put it into baseball. So I kind of did the same thing, but I think baseball will look mostly the same in 20 years. What I don't think will look the same is us around it. I think stadiums will be different. I think the fan experience will be extremely different. I think we're going to have robot umps calling balls and strikes. Thank God. I hope that's sooner rather than later. But I think if there's any single change, I think it's going to be the management of the athlete. There's something coming called, it's a bit marketing, but a bit not. It's an athlete OS, a system that's going to take all this data that we have on players and put it together to help them perform and recover and figure out who's best in this situation and that in this, the next situation. If they're going to figure out, how to change the rules of the game in this CBA, things like the pitch clock are going to kill starting pitching. That's not going to work like I think they think it's going to work. Changing the shift is not going to work like they think it works. And I actually talk about that in the book a little bit. I think it's going to be the athletes themselves that continue to get better and better and better. As much as we love romanticizing the past of baseball, these are the best players we've ever seen. And in 20 years, they're going to be even better. Just go back and look at 20 years ago. If you look at 2002, 2003, well, pretty good period because we had Barry Bonds, the best hitter we've ever seen. We had some of the greatest pitchers in the history of the game. Whether it was Maddox and Smoltz and Glavine, or whether it was Randy Johnson and Roger Clemens and Pedro Martinez, I think those kind of greats will surpass them. We'll absolutely surpass them. Nobody saw Shohei Ohtani coming. There's a kid named Sasaki, a 20-year-old wonder coming out of Japan that I hope gets to come over and play in America sooner rather than later. Heck, I hope everybody gets to come over sooner rather than later. But I think it's going to be the players and how well they can play the game and how we can help use the data to help them be better. That's going to be the biggest difference.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you. The book is The Science of Baseball. Will Carroll is the author. It's out this week, and I recommend everyone go get a copy and read it. Thank you, Will, for joining us.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.